I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. It was in August 2004 that I started the show. The word podcasting hadn't come into vogue just yet. I taped the interviews over the phone and put the recording on the website, and people had to stream them. Just over 20 years later, I'm still at it. And though I might sometimes, rarely, complain about the work that goes into the show, I can't think of anything as fulfilling an endeavor as this. To get to talk to very worthwhile people about their lives, their work, their experiences, their ideas, their ruminations on nearly every sort of topic imaginable has often been fun, as well at times an incredible privilege. When I hit 10 years of doing the show, I said I'd had more years behind me than ahead of me. I just kept on doing it, and every season brought about something new, something I probably could not have imagined 20 years ago. I was going to do one of those clip shows, you know, where you take a bunch of clips from some of the bold-faced names that have been on the show over the years. I may do just that another year, another anniversary. When I came back from summer break last fall, I went into taping shows from practically the week after signing off last May. I like pre-taping interviews, which is also a great privilege, especially when a book's weeks or even months away from being in stores. So I really didn't have time to assemble clips for a best-of show. And frankly, how could I choose from 20 years and over 2,300 shows? How do you choose between the multiple Pulitzer Prize winners, Emmy and Oscar winners, Tony winners, and members of the Order of Canada? And how do you have enough time to give a plausible overview of what's gone on from my desk the last, what'll be 21 years in August? I will take my usual summer break and return for the 22nd year of the show in late September. I've already got half a dozen names in the hopper for the fall, and that's encouraging. And I'm still a little surprised that there are those willing, sometimes wanting, to talk to me. And then there are those that don't. I'm not particularly upset about those, but I'm furious about those that don't even take the time to say no. Life has a way of sorting things out, because there's been more than a couple of people who've ended up asking to come on the show years later. I didn't want to sign off for the year and let the anniversary pass without expressing my thanks to all of those who've deigned to appear on the program. Having been interviewed, I can't imagine why people would subject themselves to my questioning. Nevertheless, I figured I owe a few answers, and put out a call on social media last week soliciting questions. I've got them printed off here, and I'll begin to answer them shortly. But I should note, other than the guests themselves, there's a group of people who are instrumental in getting guests on the show that require acknowledgement. The great publicists over 20 years I've encountered outnumber the not-so-great ones. They're often the person I talk to before and after I speak to the guests, and they're practically saintly for reassuring me that the interview will go well, especially if I might have a doubt or two. And then there are publicists that I talk to on a regular basis that they've been in touch more frequently than most relatives or friends at this point. I'd like to name them all, but I'm afraid I'll forget somebody. The good publicists will know before I do that a guest will be good on the show. For that discerning judgment, I am grateful, as listeners should. Now, to the questions. Jason Vanderhill, the historian and a good friend, asks, who had the best laugh during an interview, like a real unstoppable laugh and probably one that was mutual? There was one guest that was particularly memorable, and I won't mention them because they had quite a unique laugh. And I remember getting an email from somebody mentioning how funny they thought it was, and so I'm not going to mention who they are. Sheila Rogers told me, she's got a great laugh too, by the way. Sheila Rogers told me that Eden Robinson had one of the best laughs ever. And sure enough, when Eden Robinson came on, she's been on twice now, I think. What an infectious laugh. And what a delightful person to talk to, because I know I laughed a great deal, and she had one of those laughs that's just delightful to listen to. I thank Jason for this question. It's a great question. The novelist Sam Weeb sent in a question. If I had to draw comparisons between our current political state and one period in North American history, what would it be? I don't know. A lot of people are comparing where the United States is today to the time of the Civil War in the 1860s. I mean, a good case could be made that the comparison is apt, but I'm not smart enough to think about these things. Where it's divided, it's probably the time of Vietnam, the Vietnam War. It is incredibly divided and so polarized. But it's been polarized since 2000, since the Bush-Gore election. If Sam is asking about our current state in Canada, I would have to say, the conscription crisis shows how divided one part of the country is from the rest of the country. I'm not inclined to compare where Canada is today to, say, 1976 and 1995, the two referendums in Quebec. I mean, Alberta would like to think we're at that point, but we're not. So I would have to say, the conscription crisis, you go back to McDonald's time and resisting the pressure of the United States, its incursion into Canada. Then, someone would say that 1988 was a similar time. I'm just very pleased that Sam thought that my opinion on this question was worthwhile. His latest book, by the way, in the Dave Wakeland series, The Last Exile, that's out now, and that's on the top of my summer reading pile. Do get it, and thanks again, Sam, for the question. I posted on social media this week, just after Charles III delivered the speech from the throne opening Parliament, that, quote, I too wanted to give a speech from the throne. Richard Erickson, a loyal listener if I ever had one, asked, would you like to be Lieutenant Governor of B.C.? You'd automatically get the Order of B.C. Or would you like to be the Governor General? Then you'd automatically get an Order of Canada. Or King of Canada? I actually, when I posted that, wanted to give a speech sitting on the throne, like the crapper. And I just realized with that, this anniversary program has gone scatological far sooner than I expected. To answer Richard, though, there's no chance that I'd be king because the constitutional change to make that so would be impossible. I couldn't be Governor General because I don't speak French, or English for that matter. I think being Lieutenant Governor of British Columbia would be great because that's a marvelous way to see the province. I have a couple of things that belong to the late Gardy Gardam, former Lieutenant Governor Gardy Gardam, in my office, a couple of the viceregal flags. And then there's this cool thing, this wooden carving of a boot. He got that from the people of Port Alice when he visited. I think that would be a great job to have. I kind of wish that I'd just get the honors, like an order of whatever, without having to take on a viceregal role. Thank you, Richard, for the question and for listening all these years. My friend George Froelich wanted to know how and why the show started. It started 26 years ago. I was still in high school, grade 11, and I wanted to write. And so I figured the best way to learn how to write is to write regularly. And so I'd write these columns that I'd email to people. And then finally, the website came about as a repository of all these things, these screeds that I'd written. And about 5 years later, 2004 was when the podcast started, I had been reviewing books before that. And whenever you get one of these new books, there'd be the piece of paper, the press release saying that so-and-so, the author, was available for an interview. And I thought, well, you know, why don't I just interview the authors? You know, that's a conceit, not having broadcast anywhere, done any interviews of note, think that I could actually do it. And so I figured, well, if I book the interview, I'll tape the interview. And then I realized, well, it's too time-consuming to do the interview, prepare for the interview, of course, before that, and then transcribe the damn thing and then post that online for people to read. So I figured, why not just tape the interview and then play the tape online so people could hear the interview like radio. And so that's how this thing started, 2004, because I would wrangle these people on the line. That's why it's called on the line, because they're on the telephone line. And then play the tape. And stream the tape, I should say, and so people could listen. It was Real Player back then. I think they're out of business now. And then the MP3 would be available for download, too. Files were huge back then. And then streaming came into vogue, but it was much later that, you know, I had iTunes or Spotify. So, but people could still download the interviews or listen to them at their computers, which is probably why I also started taking the break in the summer, because I figured no one is at their computer listening. I thank George for the question. George has been a long-time guest on the show. He's a great lunch companion, and we haven't done that in a while, so I thank George for the question. Another good friend, George Orr, asked if I ever thought about marketing this vast trove of interviews. I spend enough time preparing for the interviews that I think if I devoted any other time outside of what free time I had to, say, marketing or getting the show syndicated. There was one radio station in Northern Ontario, I think, or Western Ontario, that wanted to, one of these college stations wanted to syndicate the show. If I spent any time preparing for that, or any time devoted to that, outside of preparing for the interview, which I think is the important thing, I don't think I'd do as many interviews during the year. So, I have thought about it, but not long enough. I thank George for that question. Someone, a couple of anonymous questions here, people wanting to remain anonymous. Someone asked who I think will win the Stanley Cup. So it's Thursday morning when I'm taping this. So Florida is the Eastern Conference champion, and they will go up against Dallas or Edmonton, and Edmonton's leading in that series. So Florida and Edmonton face each other in the Stanley Cup final. That's a repeat from last year. And Edmonton would probably win that, though probably Florida would win that. So I can't really come up with something definitive. Who would I like to win the Stanley Cup? I'd like the Stars to win. Dallas, actually, the Dallas Stars on their roster have three players of Filipino descent. You can look that up. I don't know. I guess Edmonton winning the Stanley Cup would be fine. I prefer Edmonton over Florida, but if given a choice of the three left, I would pick Dallas. Not that that matters. What are the lottery numbers? 5, 7, 11, 40, 46. That's 5, so I need another one if it's a 6 for now. Let's go 12. Someone else wanted to know how many buttons I have. So political buttons I have, I would figure at this point, it's been about 8 years since I started collecting with any seriousness. I'm probably at about 5,000 pieces, and that's Canadian, federal election buttons, all the provinces, and then, of course, various municipalities throughout the country, and, of course, American political buttons. I have some international ones, like British, just a few of those. And then I have about a dozen or two of Philippine buttons. I still collect them, so if you've got buttons, please send them my way. And And if I have duplicates, I usually pass them on to other collectors throughout the country. So feel free to pass those along. May Chan sent in a few questions. I have a lot of questions for May, like number one, how dare you? May asks if I have a dream guest or topic. I've got the same list that every interviewer has. So, you know, the sitting prime minister, the sitting premier, former prime minister, that would be great to have on anybody's resume. The Pope, I think, would be someone interesting to talk to, any Pope, preferably one living. David Letterman, I guess, would be at the top of my list. I think it'd be great fun to talk about Letterman's career. Not just in comedy, but in broadcasting in general, and I think he'd be interesting to talk to. I've listened to interviews that he's given in recent years, especially after he's retired, and or after he left The Late Show, I should say. And he's a guy who likes to be interviewed. And I think if I ran into him at a coffee shop or a cocktail party and asked him to do the show, I think he would probably relent. And he'd be fun to talk to. Another one at the top of my list is Paul Bissonnette. And I'd talk to Paul in a heartbeat, or Biz, as they call him. May also asks what I think defines Canadian identity today. That's an interesting question, because if to answer that question on May 29th, 2025, one would have a very different answer than, say, 6 months ago, November 29th, 2024, or a year ago even. The continental pressure of the United States, I think at this time, really defines for a lot of people what being Canadian means. To take the flag, for example, and during the pandemic or after the pandemic, how the flag was appropriated by certain people with certain political views, say, on the vaccine or Trudeau or whatever, and how since Trump's talk of the 51st state, how we've been able to reappropriate the flag, and a majority of the country feel comfortable waving that flag around. My friend Rhonda Gans gave me a Canadian flag sometime in 2024, certainly before November 2020. I can't remember when that was. And I remember saying, it was in a package, saying to her, I'd unfurl it, but I didn't want people to think that I was supportive of the trucker convoy. I'm really happy that we've come to the point, and we can thank Donald Trump for this, that the flag is not the symbol for people who used it during the whole trucker convoy bullshit. So, it could very well mean 3 months hence that how one feels about being Canadian or what one's identity is as a Canadian could very well change. That's a wonderful thing about identity itself, is that it's not just how Canadians feel about it. It's how people from without the country can influence how people from within the country feel. And we can thank the Americans and Donald Trump for making us feel a little more Canadian today than we did, say, well, 6 months ago. With that, it's probably the right time to wrap up this self-indulgent exercise in navel-gazing. I still think soliciting questions as I have, was a hell of a lot more tolerable, to me at least, than if I had brought someone in to interview me, or if I had replayed clips of interviews that I did with Stephen Quinn or Nick Thornton. Those are somewhere on the internet, and I lived through them once, and so I don't need to hear those again. I really can't say enough that I really appreciate people taking the time to listen to this. The show has been fun for the last 20 years because I've been doing them for my own interest and my own amusement. It's the show that I would listen to, and though that doesn't mean much to anybody else, I'll continue, and again, that explains why I've done it for so long. But thank you again for listening. I'll be back in late September. I'm posting this on Thursday, and then Friday there will actually be three more shows. Rodney DeCru, Tom Hawthorne, and Marjorie Simmons. So listen to those on Friday. But for now, thank you for listening again. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plata.